It is Saturday, October 4th, 2014. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio 88.9 and KUSP.org. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak.
We're through being cool. We're through being cool.
Well, welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the Geek's affiliated organizations. I'm Bonnie Jean Primchen, the host chair today, and with me in the studio is Miles Elam, a software engineer and political junkie.
Good morning.
Good morning to you, Miles. And Lyle Troxell, a maker, a photographer, a thespian, and a software engineer.
Woohoo! Long list. Hi.
Let me hear your most thespian hello.
Hello!
Very good. Okay. Well, guys...
Say bacon in your most thespian.
Bacon.
Okay. That was just in his most bacon-loving voice. Hey, Miles, you brought some kind of a cardboard doodad in.
Yes, I did.
What is this thing?
This is Google Cardboard. It's actually called Google Cardboard.
What? What do you mean it's called Google?
It was passed out at Google I.O. this year.
It's like printed cardboard. This is like die cut. This isn't just something you crafted at home.
Oh, no.
What is this thing?
Basically...
You know the Oculus Rift,
yes,
Bonnie?
Oculus Rift VR, virtual reality has been making the news, but yeah. They're fairly expensive and you need dedicated software for it and the like. And
oh, I see. That's where your phone goes.
I was looking
through the goggles, and I just like half of my vision is blocked.
And some intrepid engineers at Google decided, like, hey, you know what? People have cell phones already that have these large touch screens that are very high resolution, and if you just put in some nice lenses and stuff like that, you can get to not all the way to Oculus VR, but a good proportion of the way for really, really cheap. I believe they're going on eBay for something like $25. Or
so this is a rectangular thing that has two eye holes and two lenses, and you slide your phone into it and you put it on your face. And the lenses allow you to focus to the phone really close to your face. And of course, the camera on the phone picks up the world around you, and the software on the camera on the phone then modifies it, augments the world around you. And of course, it can do a pretty cool job of that because we got gyroscopes inside the phone and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And the device itself is just, $25, something like that?
Right. You do need an app that supports it. So there are a few out there that I have installed.
A couple bucks?
No, actually, they're free.
The apps are free. This thing is just like pushing augmented reality around.
But of course,
you do have to get the cardboard and the lenses. You know.
Well, so I was about to say
that.
How much was the cardboard thingy?
Well, for me, it...
It was free, because it worked for Google.
All
you have to do is get a job at Google. You too can have a free thing.
Or if you're at Google I.O. Or if you go online and they are being sold.
In fact, students at UCSC built these with a laser cutter and picked up some lenses. So you can actually build them yourself as well.
There's an address here, g.co/cardboard.
So if you want to learn more about it, there you go. And we'll have that up at geekspeak.org, of course.
All right, and we should take a picture of that, too, so people else can see.
In fact, put on your face, Bonnie. I'll take a picture right now with my face glasses.
With your glass.
Oh, you look ridiculous. Look for that at geekspeak.org.
The apps that I've been playing with so far, one's like a roller coaster where you go through a roller coaster and you can look all around as you're going through there, or a tunnel that you go through. Some fairly basic ones. And also like a version of Duck Hunt.
Where
except you just look at the ducks and then they get killed and it's
fairly
violent. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks for bringing that crazy thing in. Should we talk about physical web? What's that?
Yeah. Like? Yeah. Since Miles is talking about an object that connects to your face, it actually kind of reminds me of another project of Google's, actually. It's an open source project called Physical Web. And generally, you know, you've heard the Internet of Things, Bonnie. You keep on talking about that trope. Stuff will be online.
That's like when your refrigerator knows stuff.
Yeah. You have a refrigerator that knows stuff.
My honey does.
Your honey does.
My fridge knows squat all.
But, of course, one of the troubles with these things knowing things is how do you interact with them? It's not like you want necessarily your jacket to have some kind of interface or your front door to have an interface. You know, you don't want to put touchscreens everywhere. But it can be a cheap computer on it.
And you don't want to have necessarily your refrigerator have direct access to the Internet
That's
because
right.
that means the internet would have direct access to your refrigerator.
That's right. Just... So you need some way to negotiate the communication between probably your smartphone or personal computer to these devices around you. And this project of physical web is a project to say, look, let's use low Bluetooth low energy to have each of these items kind of be this kind of a beacon that can broadcast in the general area a interface that you can interact with. And what they're using is just a simple URL. So you get your new toaster. It's got no screens or anything. It connects up and says in the local area network, it says, this is my URL. And your smart device, your app on your phone.
Oh, then talks to the toaster and says, medium dark, please.
Yeah, basically, and sees an interface that it can act with. And okay. So this is the kind of initial state of just open sourcing this idea of the way to communicate with this Internet of Things. And it seems like a pretty good project. I like this general idea that the URL, the universal reference link, which is the thing like, you know, google.com or geekspeak.org, those are URLs. They are a great way to self-identify and also be unique, right? So the toaster can be toaster.com/14, you know, toaster in 14. So there's this way that very simply reference a unique identifier, and it actually happens to be something you can access through the internet. So pretty cool way of
Something that would happen automatically. It's something that goes a step beyond just having a QR code, a two-dimensional barcode, which would be another way of doing this. Just this is more automatic.
Right. So I just want to point out that though you are a big fan of Google Glass and though Miles works at Google, Google is in no way supporting the show. It is not sponsoring GeekSpeak. We are not paid mouthpieces for Google.
No, of course
not. I just want to point that out. We just happen to be fans. All right. And
that physical web,
you're a fan.
And for that matter, the cardboard. Well, the cardboard was designed by Google. There's no reason, like you said, that anyone couldn't print out one themselves.
Yeah.
Or for that matter, that they you can make an app that Google knows nothing about that.
And it uses the interface. And same with the physical web. The idea is it's the initial state. Anybody that contributes can actually move the project forward. A lot like open source projects are like that. Yeah.
Which is a pro GeekSpeak item.
Yeah.
All right. Well, in a minute, let's talk about J.P. Morgan Chase, that big breach.
Oh, yeah.
That was pretty interesting. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But first, you're listening to GeekSpeak here on 88.9 KOSP. It's also day 4 of the station's pledge drive. And this is how public radio stations like KOSP raise money to keep the station going, Miles.
Actually, it's a business model the station has considered very carefully. KOSP does what it can with support from grants, foundations, some underwriting provided by local businesses and organizations, a little bit of federal funding, and a vast majority of our funding comes from individual donations, from people like you.
Yeah.
So even as the economy continues with its challenges, we have preferred doing business this way. It makes sense to us, those of us who care about KUSP, contribute to KUSP.
KUSP is a standalone organization, guys. There's no big, rich university that's going to subsidize us.
Nope.
It's just you and me. It's just us chickens. So you see why the individual contributions that that we're talking about are critical. Your support pays for the programs you've listened to since our last membership campaign. It's a pay-as-we-go thing. That's how we do it. And that's how we've been doing it since we wound up on this place on the dial in 1972. We're asking for your gift now in an amount that fits your budget. Just that fits your budget.
You can afford a donation. I mean, because you decide how much you give. Most people contribute between $80 and $120. But whatever the amount you choose, when you give now, you get the station that much closer to having a successful pledge drive. Are you ready? Good. Here's how you do it.
Go to our website, kosp.org. Find where you click on that pledge now. And you see that? It's nice and clear. And now you'll be guided through a couple questions. Have a security submit submit your credit card. And that's all it is.
Yeah,
that's what it. That's how you make your voice clear to public radio, that it's important to you.
Nice. Hey, Miles, I want to ask you, we mentioned that we were going to be talking about the breach at JP Morgan Chase.
Yes.
Can you tell us about that?
Well, it affects 76 million households.
What? That's a lot of people.
Is that like all the households?
7 million households, 7 million small businesses.
70 million households, right?
Is that what you're saying? Sorry, 76 million.
76 million households.
7 million small businesses.
Is that just because that's how many JP Morgan Chase customers there are, or what?
I don't know if it affected all of their customers, because they have a lot of customers, but this was a large chunk.
And so what happened?
So this has Well, they got hacked.
They got hacked, basically.
And done with that story.
Okay.
I mean, more information. This is coming on the heels of 40 million cardholders and 70 million others compromised at Target. There's an attack at Home Depot that was 56 million cards.
Yeah, but those are Target and Home Depot, right? They're stores, their business models to sell things.
Right.
This is a bank, right?
Right.
Their business model is to keep the money. That's what they do.
And also... It's the largest bank in the nation, and it has information in their systems that goes beyond the credit card details. It also has the personal information.
Right, like how many people live in that house.
Well, some little hacker knows who to hit.
So this was simply one of those situations where, I mean, in the Target breaches, you had this kind of closed network system where you actually were able to connect up via a serial port device and then get into the private network. It wasn't really connected to the internet per se. The access point was through physical access to the system.
Or through a modem,
Or through a modem.
Which was basically a serial.
Right. So the question I've got for you, though, is... in this situation, was it a remote access? They got into, like, the system was actually online, or was it one of those situations that a virus was installed to access it?
That's one where I'm not quite clear. I'm seeing some conflicting reports online about it. So,
and they've made this
announcement? Because up until a few weeks ago, JP Morgan was saying only about a million accounts. Which, at the same time, it's like, a million accounts?
You said only a million, and
right,
my brain's
exactly.
exploding.
Anytime you have something that's on the internet, you have this magnifying force on anything. The things that are banal are magnified as banal. Things that are innocuous are, you know, innocuous everywhere. Mm-hmm. This one is, it's a serious breach, and it's affecting a huge number of people. So,
That's not so good.
Not so good.
So is there a lesson here for listeners who might be panicking because they're JP Chase,
you know, with
Morgan Chase customers?
You know, with this kind of I mean, of course, you know, we can say change your password and stuff. But, you know, if the data is already taken, one of those things that I'm at this point, I don't think there's anything you can do except for go,
lift your mattress, insert cash.
On the bright side thus far.
Buy gold now.
On the bright side, there doesn't seem to be much evidence of fraud relating to this breach. So there is some window here. It's not like the information was gathered months ago and now they're just noticing it. So
that's good news, I guess.
It's not great news, but it's not the worst case scenario, even though it's pretty close to the worst case scenario.
That's pretty worst case. I mean, the point is that the credit card company, like a bank like that, the information they have, of course, credit card numbers, who cares? Those can change. That is, like, not important, right? But what is important is your address, your name, your age, your family members. Oh, what? The bank has all that information. So all that information is now out and about again. Well, and that's kind of disgusting.
But this is also not to say that the banks were – I don't know their specific case.
Yes.
But – when you have something that's a large institution like that, it means that the hackers aren't just putting out a whole bunch of pings to random IP addresses and seeing if they're vulnerable to Heartbleed.
So this is a very specific attack.
Hey, this is JP Morgan. Let's see how we can get into JP Morgan. Hey, where's this access point to JP Morgan? Who are the contact points for JP Morgan? It's a very different security profile.
You know, the other thing that's interesting, of course, is that I don't know if I have an account with JP Morgan, right? Because, of course, the credit card company I deal with is actually a subsidiary of some kind, right?
So, something very disturbing happened in my abdomen. You're listening to Geek Speak here on KUSP, and when we return, we're going to be talking about flying wearables.
Oh, yeah, baby.
I can't wait to hear about that. All right, amuse me, Lyle.
Yes. You know that I like wearables, right? I wear the Google Glass thing on my face all the time.
I do know that, yeah.
If you see someone in Santa Cruz area that wears Google Glass, it's probably me.
It's probably
Please
Lyle.
Do say hi.
Wearables is just so weird
I know, it's
to me.
Wearables.
In any case, wearables are these systems
wearable
you
tech.
Wear on your tech that's on your body,
like the fancy
right?
new watch,
and it's kind of we know it's one of the next big things.
Right, but a cell phone in my pocket doesn't count as a wearable.
No, well you're not wearing it.
I'm wearing it in my pocket.
So Intel, about a year ago, kicked off this program called Make It Wearable Challenge. Okay,
but basically, like a contest.
Yeah, Intel threw in some funding and said, we're going to put money into wearable tech. So if you have a small idea and whatever, we'll help you. Mm-hmm. And that was the basic idea. And it's part competition and part entrepreneurial mentorship because some people that are involved are there to help, right? Mm-hmm. But in any case, since then, 10 teams of young entrepreneurs and developers were selected to develop their proposal into a real project. And the one that I think is fantastic just because it flies and it's a wearable – Yay, go, go, Gadget.
Wait, does that mean you fly?
No, I wish it was. No, that would be like a vehicle, I think.
Wait, so it flies, but you're not flying, so
I'm
how are you wearing it?
It becomes non-wearable.
It's a beanie that removes itself.
So it's a little, you know the quadcopters, right? These little flying quadcopters. Mm-hmm. They're the drone things.
Okay, yeah.
I hate the term drone, but yes.
Yes, it's a drone.
In any case, this is a drone that actually wraps around your wrist, right? So you wear it around your wrist. And then when you want it to take off, it does so. And, of course, it has a camera on it and connect to your phone. So anytime you want to, like, see around where you are, you just kind of push a button and it flies off your wrist and goes in the air.
So it's like a bird of prey without the big big leather
straps. You don't have to worry about its talons.
That's right. Oh, that's very good. It's kind of like having a hawk.
Yeah.
Except it's not alive.
Well, and gives you the ability like a warg from Game of Thrones where you get to look through the eyes of this thing flying over above you and get a bird's eye view.
So this little thing is called the Nixie, which is cute, and it's the first flyable and wearable camera.
It's cute, so it's innocent, right?
Yeah.
It won't hurt us in any way.
I think it's probably not going to be the stablest of drones, but it's pretty neat that it can fit on your wrist. And
I was actually thinking there's some nice creepy aspects to that.
Oh yeah.
Too.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, but Miles, it's white, orange, and red, or black, right? So if it was black, orange, and black, then it would be scary.
Right, and no one has access to spray paint.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you've got a video of it there, right? Should we put that at geekspeak.org?
We'll absolutely,
okay,
put the video
up.
It thing's really fun.
Let's talk about other fast stuff. How about bullet trains?
Yes. So Japan's Shinkansen, the bullet train,
okay,
celebrates its 50th anniversary.
Oh, it's been around for a long
They've
time.
They've had a bullet train as mass public transportation in Japan for 50 years.
And how many does the U.S. have?
Gute Frage. Well, it depends. Mm. Yeah, I don't know.
Actually, in California, a funny stat I heard a little while back, which was if you wanted to travel by train from, say, L.A. to Sacramento, you would be going slightly faster 100 years ago.
Yeah, that's pretty
sad. Than you were today.
That's sad.
Our passenger trains vie with freight rain.
Right, so they get delayed.
And
save us, Elon Musk.
Your only hope.
Oh, well.
But whereas that is a continuing of an era, there is an end of an era.
Oh,
which
what's
is
that about?
Lotus 1-2-3.
Oh, Lotus Notes?
Is
Lotus
no 1, 2, more.
Wait, wait, hold on,
no,
guys.
No, not Lotus Notes. Lotus 1-2-3, the
what
spreadsheet
is that?
Application.
Yes.
What is it?
The spreadsheet application.
Oh,
it's the predecessor to Excel.
Oh, well, before Excel.
It was the thing that was running after VisiCalc.
Let's get the timeline.
Nerd warning.
Nerd
warning.
But then Microsoft Excel came out, which actually wasn't better than 1-2-3, but it came out with Microsoft Office, which was the whole suite. So then 1-2-3 was like, but I'm better. Yeah, but we do everything.
The railroad passed the town.
And Miles, did you ever use Lotus 1-2-3 in a corporate setting?
I actually never used spreadsheets at all.
Well, then good riddance. Bye, Lotus 1-2-3.
No, it's a foundation of business and computer history in a lot of ways.
It's one of those things
that just stayed around forever in different industries.
People will constantly ask me, how do I do this thing in the word processing software? How do they do this thing in a spreadsheet application? I always be like, I don't know. But you're good at computers. Yeah, I am. So why don't you know this? Because I have no idea how that particular piece of software works.
That's why you're not as cool as me. I know Excel really well. Darn. Okay, bye, Lotus 1-2-3. Not going to be a big thing. You know Java better than I know Excel? That sounds like a challenge. A geek challenge. Quickly, tally these sums.
All right. I've been hearing stuff about like phones and if they're locked or not. Are they useful? You want to be able to unlock them?
Actually, a fun thing, which is Apple put in a anti-theft device, which was you have to find your phone, the ability to find your phone, but also that you can lock it down after it's been stolen.
Yeah.
So if someone steals a phone and then sells it to someone else, they're like, oh, yeah, and yeah, the battery isn't charged, so here you can just buy it. You charge the battery up and then just, sign up.
Oh, I've heard about this. And then you go, great. And then you turn it on. It's like, password, please. And you're like, I don't know. Is this some other person's password?
Right, because if someone has locked it down, the person who owned the phone previously would have to put in their credentials or put in their Touch ID, unlock the device, to then allow you to transfer ownership of the phone. So watch out if you're buying on Craigslist or eBay or from someone on a corner.
That's right.
But
the thing is that the person that would be selling it to you, there'd be no incentive not to do that, right? It's not like they're not going to have the device anymore.
Right.
They just said it becomes a brick. It becomes
a
completely useless piece of technology if you don't have that participation.
Right. The idea is you need to go through that process with the person,
right?
So that you know that you can get that device back. Because if it is stolen, they're going to have some song and dance about how here's the phone
the
or
contact
the battery.
Info. That's what I'm hearing.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah. So I recently had to buy an iPhone 6 Plus for work. Just to have one in place because I'm doing coding.
I'm sorry that happened to you. You poor
no,
thing.
No, it's not. It's not a personal phone. It's a work thing, right? I'm programming on it, and to do that, I actually ended up getting it on eBay, right? I actually went and found somebody and bought it.
Was it locked?
No, it was fine. It was completely packaged, but also had the receipt from the Apple Store, right? Like, I paid more money than the person paid. It's a business model that people do, right? That's how it works to some degree. But I can talk a little bit about this, like, extremely geekiness about what I'm actually doing, but I might bore the heck out of you, Bonnie, and maybe even the listeners. I don't know.
I'm giving it 2 minutes.
Okay,
go.
2 minutes. So the new iPhone 6 and 6 Plus, they're bigger, right?
Yeah.
But it also means they're different screen sizes.
Right.
And Apple, for a long time, has had, like, 1, 2, 3 screen sizes, effectively, right?
I heard this is a developer's bane.
It's a bit of a bane. It's something that we've had to deal with in the web development community for a long time.
Yeah. Well, with Android, because there are just many screen sizes and formats.
It's actually one of the things that's made it really easy to develop apps for the iPhone in general is that there's only been like a size and then plus one more size, right? It hasn't been hard like the Android environment to get the screen size right. And I know designers that are really frustrated with this idea that there's all these different partial sizes and different pixel densities too. So it gets really difficult. But what I'm finding, I'm retooling an app that allows for scaling automatically. And this is something we did on the web community for quite a while. And as long as you kind of let go of this pixel perfect perfection thing that designers have.
You speak in terms of ratios of the screen rather than pixel by pixel.
Exactly.
Yeah, a lot of ratios. Responsive design.
Responsive design, adaptive design. And then Apple is calling this new thing size classes. So it's a new way of designing. And the thing that I've noticed about it is
renamed way of designing.
iPhone app. Yeah. But it's clear that the next rev of iPads will actually have multiple split apps running at the same time, which is currently not available in Apple. But this new paradigm they're trying to switch us to is so that they can do that. And it's neat to see from a design or from a development perspective what the future goal of Apple is. Because Apple's not saying, we're going to have a new iPad and it's going to do the split screen thing. They're not saying that, right?
They can't, right? Because that ruins the surprise.
Right, yeah. I think they could, but sure.
Sure.
They think they can't.
They've got a thing. They're doing a thing.
But in the code, you can see that it's going to be multiple apps running at the same time, which is kind of neat to see that from a developer perspective.
All right.
That's my rant.
That was just under 2 minutes. Nicely done.
I've been doing this for a while.
All right. What else is happening? Tell me more things.
Facebook has a real name rule in order to have your Facebook profile.
Oh, and this has caused a ruckus, right? Because there's some people that for real reasons don't use a normal name.
Aside from a guy that I went to high school with whose name was JC, literally J period C, like, that was on his birth certificate.
You mean like Jesus Christ or what?
Well, no.
Oh, it's just literally J.C.
Yeah.
First name, J.
They were just initials. That was his name.
But when you try to put it in, they're like, that's not a real name. Yeah. So he had to choose a completely fictional name.
Yeah.
Like his nickname to put up there. Or a DJ name in this case.
Yeah.
But here, you also have the issue of in the LGBTQ community, for example, drag queens may have their stage name.
Yeah.
Or a lot of people in general, not just drag queens, would have a stage name.
Mm-hmm.
And they may be doing something, like I have another friend who's in burlesque, that you don't want people knowing your real name per se. You don't want people getting into your private life.
Right. So you want to have a modicum of privacy.
Yes.
As a performing person.
Right.
Yeah. Right. And so Facebook was actually shutting down some accounts and telling people, like, no, you have to put a real name there. You can't have
Well, they're all being flagged by one user or something. Like, a bunch of folks got flagged by one guy.
Yeah, basically, Facebook, I don't know if Facebook absolutely goes after certain, like scans and tries to figure it out. It gets reports, and then it says,
exactly.
Right. So someone's doing
it. Right, it's crowdsourced. You have people going in flagging, and then people go, hey, that's not a real name. That's against our policy, so we're going to cut it off.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Facebook has now, they're not removing the real name policy. Of which I have some issues with.
And as a result, Elo came along, right? It's this other social media thing, which is a little bit more bare bones or something. And so a lot of the LGBT community is like, screw your real name policy. Yeah. We're going over to Elo. And so there was this, they were facing
Facebook
losing
lose
some business.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, why is it that Facebook feels the need to have real names? What's the reasoning behind that? Because Google did the same thing when they launched Google+.
That's
right.
True.
It's like, it seems to be a
they've
recanted on.
Yeah,
which they have also
pulled back
on.
The idea was, and there's a couple of different things. One is that you limit the number of different accounts that people would have. You put some accountability on. So if you take away the anonymity, the thought process is that the quality of posts will go up because it tracks back to an actual person. It's not just
some pseudonym.
But
also makes it harder for abusers, right? If they have to declare their real name, then they can less trolling.
So yeah, as I've been finding, like for example, with YouTube comments. Yeah, it doesn't matter if the person has a real name. They're still
still horrible.
Stuff. Yeah.
You know, I do know I have a friend who's been taunted for years by somebody online, and he feels very strongly that everybody should have an identity that's real, that goes back legally because of the taunting aspect of that, that it can be really damaging to be haunted by somebody. And when there's fake names, you just make multiple accounts and you can be attacked by multiple people. So I see that side of it. But, you know, if you want to be anonymous to some degree or have two different personas, right, a work persona and a private persona, or if you're, you know, hunted by somebody, there's really good reasons to be anonymous online. And it seems, I'm glad that it's being pulled back, but it's a complicated problem.
There's nothing stopping someone from putting an account in that they put in information of their
grandmother,
dead uncle,
or the dog or something.
And so
you use the term LGBT. That stands for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender. It represents that group.
And don't forget
Q for
Q.
Queer?
Q for
queer?
And questioning.
Questioning.
Good.
Could be both. Dan Savage says that he hopes that eventually the whole alphabet winds up in that acronym.
Nice.
Right.
Nice. As in human. That's what it stands for at that point.
The other side of it is that Facebook, their chief product officer, Chris Cox, did apologize for that. And while they're not taking away the real name policy, they are going to be more flexible with regard to these aspects.
Okay. Well, guys, in a minute, we're going to talk about the Obama administration arguing for backdoors for personal electronics. This has been a geek fight for a long time. But right now, let's talk about raising some money for KUSP.
Woo-hoo. You know, although this program airs live every Saturday morning in the Monterey Bay area on KUSP, you may be someone who listens to the NPR podcast.
That's true.
Or visits us online at geekspeak.org. Mm-hmm. And it's you, the internet fan that I'm talking to right now. You already know what a great resource this program is, and that even in the world of NPR podcasts, there is nothing quite as good as GeekSpeak.
Well, you have a point there. Right now, I want to make sure that you understand what makes this program special. We depend, I'm going to say this, we really depend on the financial support of individual listeners. So instead of keeping advertisers happy, GeekSpeak focus can be on you where it belongs, exactly what you would expect from your own CIO or tech consultant.
If we've helped you make a good choice in the last few weeks, or if we've steered you away from trouble, let us know how much you value GeekSpeak by making a pledge right now. Click and give at KUSP.org.
And now back to news. Let's talk about the Obama administration finally doing something, advocating for a backdoor for personal electronics.
Finally doing something. Okay, they've done plenty of things.
That's true.
That I'm not particularly fond of. This is where the now lame duck, anyway, Attorney General Eric Holder Jr. Was saying that he wanted there to be backdoor, something to get past the encryption of personal devices so that law enforcement could go in and find different things like sexual predators and stuff like that.
Okay.
And it does strike me very much as the think of the kids argument, which, you know,
think of the children. The kids like what?
Yeah, the road to hell is paid with good intentions, that type of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And you have people like FBI Director James B. Comey also saying things like, we need access to this. And this is in sharp response to companies like Apple and Google, who were making sure that their devices were encrypted in a very safe way and were telling people, Apple specifically telling people during their keynote that we don't have access to the keys anymore. We can't get access to this anymore. This is just the user's information.
Oh, see, this is interesting because I thought the story was going to be about Obama's administration saying, you know what, people should be able to unlock their own phone and get in.
Oh, back to us.
Just so they can get in there.
Yeah,
yes.
I mean, basically, you know, Apple's doing this, like I've talked about before, Apple's doing this pretty intelligent thing about making really hard to crack privacy on your device.
And it came up with regard to the iCloud breach where a bunch of celebrities got new photos swiped from them.
That stuff was, you know, know, attacked via the cloud service, not the device. The device has been pretty good. In fact, it's getting better and better. And these devices are such that if you set up a password when you first start your phone, long password, and you use your thumbprint ID, there is no way to get into that access, right? No, doesn't matter what you do besides having that thumbprint or that passphrase, you're not going to get access to that data. It's encrypted, high-level encryption. So if somebody, you know, if somebody is a criminal and the authorities want to investigate, they have a sticky situation. So this argument is, you know, I see the reason for the argument. It's a counter to this. But I like the idea of privacy.
If it were possible to give that backdoor, just make it available for law enforcement while still having the protections of that encryption work, I could see the argument.
Yeah,
but
I
you can't.
Right.
You can't make something that is a strong lock that has the ability for someone else to have a little separate key that goes in there.
And this is the thing that Apple's doing.
That bad actors can't go in and use that same backdoor.
In fact, the design methodology is such that to make it secure requires mathematically for you not to have that backdoor, right? It's not like it's technically challenging, it's hard. No, it's not about hard. It's about if you do that, it's not secure. That's by definition, that's what it does. So you could do something where you had a second trusted person and have some kind of society thing of like you take your device down to a mayor and you say, hey, mayor, I'm going to add you to my phone so that if I do a criminal act later, you can actually get into it. But that kind of thing, of course, doesn't work, right?
Yeah.
Because criminals won't do that.
Yeah.
So
if you put
the backdoor in, anybody could access it.
And then you have the issue of at those companies, do you have a disgruntled employee that decides want to look at a jilted lover's information because those devices are everywhere. They're in everyone's hands.
And keep in mind that it is damaging for a company like Apple to put this kind of high-level security in because if the person forgets their password, the data is gone. And the person that, you know, is in that situation where we'll say, hey, no, Apple, help. You know, I just lost my password. I need to help. Apple has to say, I can't. We can't help you. It's impossible to. We set up such that you own it. You're the rights are yours.
Right.
And I think that personal responsibility with technology is an interesting step in our evolution because I think until now, we've been in the space where, well, I can just get my geek friend to help and they'll be able to figure it out. But we're building into this idea of personal responsibility at a high level so that phone represents who you are. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I see this future like Tim Robinson's written in the Mars trilogy, Red, Blue, Green, Mars. He's put into that trilogy this idea that the personal device becomes your voting tool, becomes the representation of you in the society. I see that more and more without having this kind of hard line of, no, you're the only one responsible for the data in that phone. Nobody else can get to it. You can't have a system of trust and a democracy working based off of that technology. So I want that technology.
So everything's broken? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying that technology needs to be fundamental.
Like, more than ever before in human history, the technology isn't broken.
Yes, right. It's getting better.
The technology is working exactly the way it's supposed to be working.
And the federal government's arguing to break it. Oh, it's
yeah.
so frustrating.
Well, kind of the state government too, right? California cops, they no longer need warrants to surveil with drones.
Yeah, that's a whole other thing.
What's
governor,
Jerry Brown doing?
Jerry Brown vetoed legislation that went through the California legislature that would have required warrants for surveillance using unmanned drones.
Mm-hmm.
And in the message, he was saying, quote, this bill prohibits law enforcement from using a drone without obtaining a search warrant, except in limited circumstances. There are undoubtedly circumstances where a warrant is appropriate. The bill's exceptions, however, appear to be too narrow and could impose requirements beyond what is required by either the Fourth Amendment or the privacy provisions of the California Constitution. That is true.
Yeah.
At the same time, I also wonder why is the Fourth Amendment or the California Constitution, the privacy provisions of the California Constitution, the absolute bare minimum that we have to have? It either has to be encroaching on them or right back at them.
Yeah.
It can't be more than that.
Huh. I don't know. It creeps me out. I'm just going to say that. It creeps me out that they don't need a warrant for snooping around.
Right. That is the thing about our society right now is that with all of this technology, we have something that the East German Stasi from the Cold War would have died for, that ability for surveillance. So there has to be some pushback in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean to say that California is like East Germany during the Cold War. I'm not saying that. I don't want to put on the tinfoil hat in that
regard.
We're
not there yet.
but I do want people to be aware of the fact that if you're going to go that much further with technology to allow this, then there needs to be some protections on the other direction pushing back.
Right on. You sing it. You sing it, brother.
And I get off my soapbox.
There we go. This has been Geek Speak for October 4th, 2014. With me, Bonnie Jean, Lyle Troxell, and Miles Elam. Geek Speak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And Geek Speak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, so use our stuff any way you like. But just tell them the geeks say hi. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSB Santa Cruz, live online at KUSB.org. To find out more about this or any episode of Geek Speak, please visit geekspeak.org. Thank you for listening and for giving at 888-777-1507 or KUSP.org.